morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls, expecting you to call in with whatever question may be on your mind about the Bible or the Christian faith, Christian doctrine or ethics or practice or Christian history, Christian apologetics, any of those things. We have an open discussion about such things here. And we'd be glad to talk to you about any of them that are on your mind. If you have an alternate viewpoint from the host or would like to discuss a different point of view, balanced comment for us here, we would be glad to have you do that as well. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278 if you'd like to be on the program today. And our first caller today is from Detroit, Michigan, and it's Timothy. Timothy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Yes, sir. I'm up here snowed in Detroit, and I'm just calling to let you know that I listen to mostly archived programming, and I have been enjoying and getting an education very much, and I did have a question for you. I'll try to be brief.
Okay.
I respect your opinion on several things, and I'd like to get your take on Matthew chapter 2, where Jesus comes back to Nazareth. And the verse in question is basically comes down to, after all is said and done, in verse 23 it says, and he came and dwelled in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. Now, I noticed that in the Geneva Bible it says Nazarite. I've looked everywhere in the Old Testament. The word does not appear. And the only closest thing that I got coming on it is that it might be a synonym for meaning something of a despised nature or originating from perhaps the branch. Are you familiar with this? And have you addressed it before? And or could you address it now? And I also wanted to ask you if you're going to be able to have your programs of the last week available for reviewing.
Okay, the morning, the half-hour programs, are they not up at the website?
Well, I didn't notice them. Yesterday I went to try to download. I usually download a week in advance, or I should say a week into the week past, and listen to them because I make use of the library and
I'll check into it. I don't usually check the website to see if they're uploaded or not, but they're supposed to be uploaded kind of automatically every day. So I'll see if there's been a snag there somewhere. But sure, I'll be glad to talk about the Matthew 2 issue.
Okay.
All right. Now, notice it says that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, plural. This is the fourth time in Matthew chapter 2 that there's a reference to what the Old Testament says. And, for example, back in verses 5 and 6, it says, so they said to him that the Messiah be born in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, singular. And it quotes Micah 5:2. And then later on in verse 15, it says, and he was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, singular. Out of Egypt I called my son. And then in verse 17 it says, then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, and so forth. Now, there's prior to the verse you're talking about, there are three references to Old Testament prophecy that are fulfilled in the life of Jesus. But then when it comes to this one, verse 23, as it was spoken by the prophets, plural. Now, that gives the impression that perhaps Matthew here is not quoting a particular prophet, as he did in the previous cases, but perhaps summarizing what was spoken by prophets, plural. That is, he's not quoting an actual prophecy, but rather giving sort of a summary of something that more than one of the prophets had said. And what he represents it as, he should be called a Nazarene. Now, you said, was it the Geneva Bible that said Nazarite?
Actually, yes, the Nazarite, looking up the word Nazarene, I've only got one reference.
Okay, well, I just wondered, because Yeah, the reason I ask is that no Bible should put Nazarite in there.
The Geneva Bible Nazarite. Says Nazarite.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's a very bad translational choice on their part. A Nazarite, of course, was a person who took a Nazarite vow, described in Numbers chapter 5. And a Nazarite would not cut his hair, would not touch anything from the grapevine, would never touch a dead body. Those are the things that a Nazarite would do. But Jesus touched dead bodies, and he also drank wine. And if people don't like the idea of him drinking wine, they could say he drank grape juice, and that would still be a violation of the Nazarite vow. Jesus was not a Nazarite. John the Baptist was.
Right.
And Jesus made that distinction. He said, John the Baptist came neither eating meat nor drinking wine, and you say he is a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say, look, a wine bibber and a glutton and a friend of sinners. So Jesus made it very clear that although John the Baptist was a Nazarite, Jesus was not. So there's certainly no prediction in the Old Testament that the Messiah would be a Nazarite. And if there was, then Jesus wouldn't qualify because he wasn't one. So for them to change Nazarene to Nazarite is totally misleading. Now, the word Nazarene...
I thought it was strange.
Yeah, the word Nazarene has nothing to do with being a Nazarite. A Nazarite is a person who took a vow of a certain sort. A Nazarene is a person from Nazareth, just like a Californian is a person from California. You know, I mean, a Nazarene means somebody from Nazareth. But there is no Old Testament passage that says that the Messiah would be a Nazarene. And therefore, since Matthew... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, are you finding in your studies anything relating to the Nazarene as being a despised...
I'm getting to that, yeah. Some commentators think that Nazareth was a town which had a bad reputation, and that being called a Nazarene or a person from Nazareth would be like being called someone from the wrong side of town. Someone from a town that had a bad reputation would have therefore a bad reputation for having come to when Rush Limbaugh says, for those of you in Rio Linda, he's referring to people that he considers to be not very intelligent people. It's sort of the town has gotten that reputation from Rush Limbaugh frequently using the term, although probably not everyone in that town is what he characterizes them as. But the point is that if a person is called a Nazarene, it's almost like being called a Cretan in Titus. You know, the Cretans are all lazy gluttons, one of their poets said, and Paul said, that's true, these people are Cretans. But Nazarene, the prophets do say that the Messiah would be mistreated, would be humiliated, would be verbally abused, and so forth, in Isaiah 53 especially. And so some people think that when Matthew says the prophet said he would be a Nazarene, that what Matthew's really arguing is this, that Jesus came from Nazareth, and therefore, as a Nazarene, he did suffer reproach in his culture. And that fulfills prophecies that said the Messiah would suffer such reproach. And therefore, by sort of a stretch, we could say it's as if they said he would be called a Nazarene because they said he'd be the object of reproach. Now, I don't think this is a good answer at all. For one reason, we don't even know that Nazareth had a bad reputation. The reason that people say that is because of one sentence in John chapter 1, where when Jesus met heard about Nathanael, Nathanael heard about Jesus, and Philip told him he's Jesus of Nazareth. Nathanael said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Now, a lot of people say, that response indicates that Nazareth had a bad reputation because Nathanael said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Therefore, on the basis of that statement and that statement alone, Christians have often said, Nazareth was a town with a bad reputation. But Nathanael's statement doesn't have to mean that, and there's no other evidence anywhere in history the Bible, Nazareth had a bad reputation. And it's possible that what Nathanael is saying is, you're telling me the Messiah came from Nazareth in Galilee? We can't expect someone important like that to come from our district. You see, Nathanael himself was a Galilean, and Nazareth was a Galilean town. It might be that he's simply saying Nazareth is not someplace like Jerusalem. not someplace like you'd expect an important person like the Messiah to come to. You wouldn't expect him to come from our district up in Galilee, where Nazareth is. And he might not be saying anything really bad about Nazareth at all. So there's absolutely no reason to say that Nazareth had a bad reputation, and that's the whole foundation for that one explanation. You know, the reason he's called a Nazarene because it had a bad reputation. Well, we don't know that he did. It did. So I don't accept that. Now, I do accept the second explanation, which I think you alluded to. Nazareth was a town that comes from the word netzer in Hebrew, which means branch. Nazareth means the town of the branch. Now, there were a number of prophets who referred to the Messiah as the branch. Zechariah did, Jeremiah did, Isaiah did. And therefore, the branch was sort of a nickname in some of the prophets for the Messiah, the branch. Now, Jesus came from a town that's called the town of the branch. And I think that's what Matthew's alluding to. Isn't that interesting that he would come from the town of the branch, like the prophets said? Well, they didn't say he'd come from the town of the branch, but they did say he'd be called the branch. And if he's called the branch and he came from the town of the branch, I think Matthew sees that as a significant thing. Now, Matthew didn't make this point, nor did anybody else in the Bible, but Jesus came from Bethlehem also. He was born in Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem means house of bread. And since Jesus called the bread of life, Matthew could have similarly said, you know, the bread of life came from the house of bread, from Bethlehem. He was born in Bethlehem. And look at that. The bread of life is born there in the house of bread. Now, no one made that point, and I wouldn't expect them necessarily to do so. But it would be a similar thing. I think it would be a very similar thing to saying, well, look, here's Jesus, the branch. The Messiah is the branch. And lo and behold, he comes from the town of the branch, Nazareth, which means town of the branch. And I think he's stretching a little bit. But he's seen something that he thinks is significant. He says, you know, the prophets, plural, did speak of the Messiah as the branch. And what do you know? Jesus lives his life as a youth in the town of the branch. And I think that's all that Matthew is doing. I don't think he's trying to point to some particular prophecy that's fulfilled, which is why he uses the plural. It was spoken by the prophets.
Very good. Well, that was that's one of the only real passages that I had a stone in my shoe about, and I've been looking at it for a long time, and I do appreciate your intake, and I hope to keep up with your archived. I can't listen to you live.
Right, we'll try to get those. We'll try to get those archives up if they're not there. I'm not sure what happened to them, but I sure appreciate your call. God bless you. Oops, I'm sorry, I hit the button, didn't know you were going to speak again. Let's talk to Keith from Santa Fe Springs, California. Keith, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah, I have a question regarding Genesis chapter 32, Jacob sees God's face face to face. Is that figuratively or that event is actually happening?
I think it really happened. Some people think that story is a dream that Jacob had, sort of a nightmare, but I think it's told as if it's a true story. What happened was that a man wrestled with Jacob all night long, and Jacob and the man were about equally matched, and neither of them was prevailing against the other. And at the end, when the sun was rising, the man said, "The day is breaking. You got to let me go. I can't stay." And Jacob said, "I won't let you go unless you bless me." And the man said, "What's your name?" And he said, "My name's Jacob." And the man said, "Well, it's going to be Israel now, from now on." And he, in the course of wrestling with Jacob, had touched his thigh and supernaturally crippled him or shriveled the muscle there. And so after that encounter was over, Jacob limped for the rest of his life. So we know that it wasn't just a dream. Something really happened there. He had a crippling condition inflicted on him at that time. And he said afterwards, he says, I've seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. He named the place Peniel, which means face of God, because he said he'd seen God face to face. Now, I believe he did. Now, you might say, but then doesn't the Bible say no one has ever seen God? And didn't God tell Moses, no one can see my face and live? How could Jacob then have seen God face to face? And that's what he marveled at. He said, I've seen face to God face to face, and I lived. I survived. What happened there, I believe, and this is a pretty much just a standard evangelical explanation of that, is that the man who wrestled with Jacob was God appearing in a human form, as he sometimes did in the Bible. From time to time, God appeared in a human form. God is not a human being, but he took on a human form in order to be seen and to interact with some important man on some important occasion. For example, in Genesis 18, when Abraham was in his tent, he looked up and he saw the Lord in the form of three men were coming toward him. One was the Lord, two of them were angels, and he fed them. They ate with him. They were obviously physical. And then the two angels left and went to Sodom to destroy it. And God stayed there with Abraham and talked with Abraham. Now, this is certainly an occasion where the Bible unambiguously says that God appeared in a human form and talked with and ate with Abraham. Now, most evangelicals, I think, would suggest that this man who wrestled with Jacob is another instance of God appearing in a human form and wrestling with Jacob. Now, the meaning of the encounter, well, that's complicated. It was a very important transition in Jacob's life. He was leaving 20 years of serving his crooked uncle Laban, and he was being pursued by him, or had been, and had just had an unpleasant encounter with him. Then his brother, who had threatened to kill him 20 years earlier, was now coming with 400 armed men to meet him. And Jacob was pretty stressed out, and he didn't sleep well that night. In fact, he wrestled all night. And some people think that, you know, he just had this dream, this troubling dream because of these circumstances. But I think the Bible tells it as if God really did come to him in this form and wrestle with him and cripple him and rename him. And this was preparatory to his going back into the promised land. Again, the meaning of it is much deeper than I could give at this moment because of the restraints on our time. Although I do talk about it in detail in my lectures on Genesis. If you want to download those, they're free. Of course, everything's free at the website. But if we say, well, how could Jacob see God and live? Well, I believe that when the Bible says that no one can see God or that no one has seen God, what it means is that nobody, no human eye, has seen the unveiled glory of God. The Bible indicates that when Jesus comes back, his glory is going to be so great that the heavens and the earth will flee from his face because it's so bright. There's no more place for them, it says in Genesis 20. And the glory of God is so great, I think that if a human being really saw it, it would, frankly, even the earth and the heavens can't tolerate it. So when he reveals himself to man, he does so through certain veiling methods, sometimes through a vision, sometimes in the manner that we're discussing, what's usually called a theophany. In the Greek word theophany means an appearance of God in a physical form. But in a physical form, he's veiling himself. Even Jesus on earth was God veiling himself in a human form, because it says the Word was made flesh and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. They did see God, but they saw him veiled in human flesh. And Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, refers to Christ's body as a veil, as it were. So Jacob and others, Abraham, did see God veiled in a human-like flesh form. Other people in the Bible saw him in what we call visions and dreams. But he told Moses, no one can see his face. And I think that means God's unveiled glory, because Moses had said, show me your glory. Well, Moses had already seen a lot of God at that point. But he was asking to see, you know, for God to pull away the curtain completely. And God was saying, I can't do that. You wouldn't survive it. But I'll just show you this little bit. But the point here is that it is, in fact, my belief that Jacob's encounter with that man was an encounter with God himself. Let's talk to Ari from Fallbrook, California. Hi, Ari. Good to hear from you.
In the past, you used to talk about these meetings in Temecula. Are you having any more?
Sometimes we do. we're not holding them in the same location that we once did, but we do have one that we're going to be having in February. What date is that? February 8th. It's not in the it's not on the website yet because we've just been nailing down the location. But it will, if you have access to our website, you can you'll be able to find it there a bit well in advance. We're having it's going to be at the Temecula Boys and Girls Club, which is going to be February 8th. But the address and location will be posted at the website, and of course I'll announce it on the air when we have the specifics and when the time is approaching.
What happened to the one in where you were meeting?
Well, that place did, became unavailable for a while. It may be available in the future.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, Ari. Good to talk to you. Let's talk to Troy from Orange County, California. Hi, Troy. This is my atheist friend, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm calling because I had a question this morning about witches in the Bible. I wanted to ask, in the Old Testament, we are told, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And historically,
right,
especially in the medieval period, this was justification for witch burnings. I wanted to ask
right.
you, does this, I know this is probably a silly question, but does this still apply today? And if so, or if it does not, why not? And I'll clear the line. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Troy. Good to hear from you. In my mind, that's not a silly question at all. I think it's a reasonable question. If Israel was told not to permit witches to live, why should we let witches live? There is a very good reason for that. One, most people don't realize when they read the Old Testament that they're reading specific laws given to a specific nation called Israel that had a very specific relationship with God and specific covenant with God. Now, most modern people don't even know what a covenant is. But the closest thing we have in our modern society to a covenant is a marriage. That's a marriage covenant between a man and a woman. It makes the woman and the man in a special relationship that's unique. A man who's married, it doesn't have a relationship with any other women that in any way resembles his relationship with his wife, and vice versa. It's a unique and special relationship between two people. Well, God had that kind of relationship with Israel. He made a covenant with them as a nation. And in that covenant relationship, they were not allowed to be like other nations. God was not going to do anything for the other nations like what he was going to do for Israel. And Israel was not supposed to worship other gods or the gods of other nations or whatever. They're supposed to be loyal to him. Now, the laws that we read about in the Old Testament are the laws that God gave to Israel in the context of that covenant. They were not going to get away with stuff that other nations could because they were God's people and God held them to a higher standard. They weren't allowed to practice witchcraft. They weren't allowed to worship other gods. They weren't allowed to be sexually deviant. They weren't allowed to rob or kill or bear false witness. The laws that God gave them was holding them to a certain standard. And that standard was the law of the land. And any deviation from it was like treason against your king. You see, God was their king, is how it was understood. And they were his kingdom. And so to violate his laws, especially in any way that would defect from him, would be like treason against your king. Now, witchcraft and other occult practices were forbidden. Worshipping other gods were also forbidden. And these were things that did have a death penalty attached to them. Now, the other nations that were not Israel, God didn't regulate their behavior like that because they weren't Israel. Israel was his special people, and he wanted them to be different. He wanted them to be specially his and in a special relationship with him and untainted. He didn't show the same concern for the other nations round about, and therefore witchcraft and idolatry were practiced regularly, and God didn't punish them for that. He did punish some of the nations for their atrocities they committed against innocent people and so forth, but he never punished another nation just because they weren't worshiping him, because he didn't expect the other nations to. Now, today, it's very different. First of all, there is no nation on the planet that has that kind of relationship with God. And therefore, these laws, civil laws about putting to death people who do certain things are not necessarily applicable. Now, some laws would be, for example, laws against murder and theft and so forth are fairly universal standards that all nations follow. But laws, about keeping the Sabbath, laws about not permitting other religions, not permitting witches, not permitting the occult, laws about not profaning the name of God. These are not laws that secular nations are required to enact. However, Christians are supposed to live by God's standards, but not to kill people who don't. Christ never came with a command to kill anybody, and Christians in the Bible wouldn't kill anybody. They wouldn't even defend themselves when people were trying to kill them. So the stoning of witches or the stoning of adulterers or the stoning of children who curse their parents, things like that, they were strictly laws given to Israel because of their special relationship with God and his holding them to a higher standard. We Christians don't expect the nations of the world in making their laws to enforce such penalties against those people. Now, we would desire to convert people to Christianity, and although we Christians don't kill people, we do feel that certain behaviors are still unacceptable, obviously, because when we become a Christian, when we follow Jesus Christ, we're coming into a relationship with Christ similar to what Israel had with God. It's a covenant relationship. And therefore, our obedience to Christ is very important. One difference is God doesn't kill us. That is, he doesn't put a death penalty on our disobedience if we disobey Christ. But we still are committed to obey him because he is our king if we are Christians. And so we don't kill people, but we still would be against witchcraft. We'd still be against sexual deviance. We'd still be against those kinds of misbehaviors. But there's no mandate in Scripture for Christians to kill anybody, and I don't think any Christian should in any circumstance, except perhaps if they're a soldier or a policeman. And some people think Christians shouldn't even do that. We won't discuss that now because we're out of time, but Troy, I hope that clears some things up. We're out of time for today's program. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this every weekday morning for a half hour. We're listener supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again soon. God bless you.
Hello, good morning. We're glad you're listening to KBright AM 740 to hear The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. This live interactive call-in program is making its mark in Christian radio, and it's a great service that Steve provides to the body of Christ. If you'd like to be able to support this program, you want to make sure that when you flip on that radio at 9:30, you get to hear Steve Gregg, then do go to his website, thenarrowpath.com, and there's a place there that you can give safely and securely. That's at thenarrowpath.com. However, if you'd like to be able to make a donation in another way, you don't want to do it online, then give us a call here at KBright for other contact information for Steve Gregg. Our number here at the station is 800-227-2337. Please remember that the views and opinions on The Narrow Path are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Next up, it's Joyce Meyer on AM 740 KBright.
Electric cars cost less to operate, so why do some states want to change that? We'll talk about that at 3. Plus, today's the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. So how's that working out? I'm Roger Marsh. These stories and more today at 3 on The Bottom Line on AM 740 KBright.
Strengthening the local body of Christ. This is 50,000 watt KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Healthy Living, Spirit, Soul, and Body. Entering into this new year, you probably have created resolutions or set goals that you plan to achieve in the next 12 months. You might want to be healthier, do more good for others, or grow closer to God. Those are great goals, but it can be a challenge sometimes to balance these desires. On today's program, Joyce will help you balance these tasks as she teaches on living a healthy lifestyle. You might think that your spirit, soul, and body are separate when it comes to living, when in fact all three of them virtually work together and help bring you that much closer to God. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Healthy Living, Spirit, Soul, and Body.
As I said, it's impossible to have a healthy life and an unhealthy mind. Just that simple. So you can just write this down. Can't do it here while I'm teaching, but you need to have a meeting with yourself. And you need to ask yourself, what is my mind like? If we could turn your mind into a picture screen and show everybody in here what goes through your mind in a day, would you like that? And sometimes we think, well, it doesn't hurt to think it. Nobody knows anyway. Well, that's not true, because thoughts lead to actions. The Bible says plainly, as a man thinks, so does he become. I say it a little different way. Where the mind goes, the man follows. It's pretty simple. You think about a hot fudge sundae long enough, you're going to go get one. So you have to be very careful what you put your mind on. Ephesians 4:22. I'm trying to go a little slow today because I want to make sure that you have a little Selah time here. That means time to pause and kind of think about what I'm saying. Sometimes we preachers can just spill it out so fast that it sounds great, but nobody knows what we said when we got done. Ephesians 4:22 says, strip yourselves of your